But sadly, the conditions of vulnerability, living conditions especially, are horrible in most agricultural communities. So what we are seeing, all the dangers of climate change. Communities like Immokalee across the entire state are suffering more than other communities. So we're still trying to assess the impact of Hurricane Milton across the central part of Florida. And we are going to be trying to support those communities like we have done in the past. This time we were lucky that it didn't hit us directly, but we know that other communities are suffering and are going to be needing support that are in a desperate situation right now. So we will be taking steps to try to support them as much as we can.
And as we wrap up, we have 5 seconds, but the major, the countries where so many of the farm workers come from, Haiti in your area in Immokalee, Haiti, Mexico.
And Guatemala, yeah.
And Guatemala, Gerardo Reyes Chavez, a farm worker, senior staff member, organizer at the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in Southwest Florida, which also runs a radio station called Radio Conciencia, which helps immigrant workers prepare for hurricanes. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and International Travel Group. KBOO and ITG are organizing a trip to Cuba. Deadline to register is Friday, October 25th. More information at kboo.fm/Cuba.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County and Portland keep trying to find a way to solve houselessness. What some key leaders have to say about their latest efforts.
To move from homelessness quickly back to housing and stability.
The leading candidates for Portland mayor make their pitches to voters. And two Oregon lawmakers are speaking out about the tragedies and dangers of anti-Semitism. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 10th, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Multnomah County and Portland leaders have been trying to work together on the crisis of houselessness in our community. They've set ambitious targets and goals and talk about the urgent need for action. This week, the groups involved came together for discussion about what's being done and what progress has been made. It started with Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson and Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler.
A quick recap of how our homelessness response system and our partners are making progress towards goals laid out in our homelessness response action plan. We'll also recap our mutual efforts to move milestones forward in the county resolution and city ordinance that emerged from the IGA discussions this summer. While there may be diverse viewpoints, I'm committed to continuing to provide this transparent public space for these discussions to take place and for all of the work that's needed that helps move. We will have new commissioners on the board and at city council, and which will operate very differently in January. For our benefit, as well as our partners and community members, the Homelessness Response System team, with the support from city partners who helped lead this work, created an extensive background document that details progress to this point. We've seen many of the major initiatives and milestones laid out in the HRAP move significantly forward since our last discussion, with two-thirds of these action items completed in less than 3 months, many ahead of schedule or right on time. And now I'm happy to turn things over to Mayor Wheeler.
I want to thank the respective staffs of Multnomah County and the City of Portland. I want to apologize for my voice. I took a trip to Japan recently to visit our sister city in Sapporo. I came back, but my voice didn't. And so I apologize. I want to express my deep appreciation for your continued dedication to our collaborative efforts. Our agenda today is to engage in discussion about the early progress of our Homeless Response Action Plan and, of course, the pivotal and challenging work that lies ahead. We've seen considerable advancements in our collective mission to address homelessness. Let's focus on how we can further enhance our cooperation and ensure that our efforts are both effective as well as sustainable over the long run.
My name is Ryan Dibert. I am the interim director of the Homelessness Response System. We're hoping to provide background and updates on the homelessness. Most of you are relatively familiar with the HRAP. It was drafted concurrently with the Intergovernmental Agreement to create the Homelessness Response System. A draft of the HRAP was shared publicly in March with extensive public feedback and briefings to Portland City Council and to this board of county commissioners. It was finalized and adopted through the IGA that was implemented in early August. It's a short to medium term plan to address homelessness with a strong focus on expanding services and improving alignment across health, behavioral health, employment, public safety, and housing and homeless services systems. All of that with the aim to help people get better access to the services they need to move from homelessness quickly back to housing and stability. It's a systemic approach and it has a strong focus on short-term reductions in unsheltered homelessness. There are 120 action items in all. It's the most detailed and articulation of the respective roles of the city, county, and our multiple partners that I've personally seen in the 2 decades that I've been working in this policy space here in Portland. Each of those 9 goals and 120 action items are meant to be in direct service to these key metrics: sheltering or housing 2,700 additional people by the end of 2025. That's a number equivalent to half of those who were known to be experiencing unsheltered homelessness in January of 2024.
And that was part of the discussion about the joint efforts on homelessness between Multnomah County and Portland this week. Meantime, 5 of the top candidates running to be Portland's next mayor faced off at a Portland City Club debate. Current City Commissioner Rene Gonzalez talked about why he wants the job.
I'm a 5th-generation Portlander, father of 3, and lifelong Democrat. I have proudly served you as a city commissioner for just over 20 months. And during that time, I have been the standard bearer for public safety and livability in the city of Portland. Today, there are more firefighters, police officers, 911 dispatchers, and ambulances on the streets of Portland than when I entered public service. We have seen drug recriminalization and decreasing 911 wait times, in part through my leadership. I have worked with my colleagues on city council to support large village sites with services that are showing success before they were popular. And I am running to be your next mayor to continue that work. I'm looking to serve a city centered on the following values: families can grow in the city, seniors can age in place, Portland will be welcoming to all who abide by the social contract. I also look to see your next mayor as a champion across this globe, across this country, to tell of Portland's good graces, to protect it from chaos, and to be an advocate for taxes paid and quality of services.
My name is Mengus Maps, and I am running for mayor. I do truly believe this is both the most unique and most important election that Portland has seen in the last 100 years. I see lots of familiar faces and some new ones too. For those of you who don't know me, let me introduce myself. As I said, my name's Mengus, longtime Portlander, most important, a dad of 2 boys, 14-year-olds and 15. Both are in high school at this point. Served on council for the past term, essentially. During my time on council, I have been your infrastructure commissioner. So I've been the guy in charge of water, roads, and environmental services. My portfolio accounts for about one one-third of the city's employees, half the city's budget, and 95% of the city's assets. During my time on council, I've been key in bringing down... I'm bringing down call wait times at 911, bringing on more police officers. As your next mayor, I'm going to focus in on homelessness, public safety, and economic recovery.
It's such a great honor to be here amongst you and to see so many Portlanders so passionate about city politics. The last time I had a crowd this big was at the Moda Center when I delivered a TED Talk in 2022. This is very exciting, the engagement. So my name is Liv Oss. That's Norwegian for Viva Las Vegas. I've been a dancer downtown at Mary's Club, a family-run business, for the last 28 years. Thank you. I was born in South Dakota, raised in Minnesota. My dad's a preacher. My mom's a teacher. I went to Williams College. I studied cultural anthropology. I lived in Germany and East Africa and Indonesia all the time. I'm just studying how cities do things great and how they do things not so great. I come from an artist background. I've spent 28 years dancing, having bands, singing opera, and raising a daughter who's 9. I have 2 published books. So I bring a very different background to the mayor's race. I'm running because I want to see new leaders. I'm tired. Thank you. I'm tired of seeing the same old leaders, the politicians lead. In my travels, I've seen different leaders, matriarchy, chiefs. It's time for a different mayor, a different leadership, and this type of mayor system, the weak mayor, is perfect for a new leader who can be a visionary and a storyteller.
Next, Portland City Commissioner Carmen Rubio.
I am the daughter and granddaughter of immigrants, and I grew up, and I am a lifelong Oregonian, and I'm running for mayor because I love this city, and I'm also running because I have an honest recognition of where we are as a city, both our problems and our strengths, and I don't have to tell you that we have serious work to turn our city around, and that's why we need a mayor who will meet the urgency of the moment and get things done. And tonight you'll hear many of the same things that we all largely agree on. We all want more safe streets and neighborhoods and more police officers in our city. We all also want more state and federal funds to tackle homelessness and more housing. And we also are committed to revitalizing our downtown core and strengthening our small businesses. We know what our work is and what it's cut out to be, but talk and actions are meaningless. Outcomes are what matters. So the real question before you is who will deliver effective solutions on these important issues? I'm the only candidate who's shown time and time again the ability to tackle these big issues and produce real results for Portland, from catalyzing housing development at every level and reforming our permitting process to unlocking millions of dollars from the Portland Clean Energy Fund and putting it into the local economy and the community. I know how to build coalitions and to call the questions and get things done. I believe in our city, and I also believe with common sense, collaboration, and hard work, our best days are still ahead, and we can get there together.
My name is Keith Wilson, and I'm running for mayor to deliver real change to Portland. We need to take a hard look at where our city is today. Over the past year, Portland had the worst job creation out of 50 cities. Office vacancy rate is at 30% and climbing, the worst in the nation. And we now have the highest unsheltered homeless rate in America. Our new form of government needs someone who knows how to build teams, who understands logistical complexity. It needs an innovator with the leadership and the grit that can get the hard jobs done. My opponents had years to build coalitions and deliver results and haven't. They've refused to follow the path that other cities have taken to solve the most crucial issues of our time. They've wasted hundreds of millions of dollars. And as a result, we've lost families, jobs, small businesses, and worst of all, lives. Look, if you like the way the city's being run, then I'm not your guy. But if you want real change, then vote for me. My experience is vast and relevant and will meet the crucial moment that our city now faces. The Portland Renaissance that we all want is within our reach. And together, if we work together, we can repair, restore, and revitalize this most incredible city that we all love.
And those were 5 of the people running to become Portland's next mayor. For the first time in November's election, voters will use ranked choice voting to select their mayor. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In-Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, clouds rolling in down to a low 51. Tomorrow's weather, mostly cloudy with a high of 72. On this date in history, in 1935, the opera Porgy and Bess by George Gershwin opened on Broadway with an all-black cast. Our quote of the day is from Gershwin about his creation. "I think the music is so marvelous, I don't believe I wrote it." This week, Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden joined the many people marking the anniversary of the October 7th terrorist attack in Israel. Wyden visited the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education in Portland, and he commented on the anniversary and the latest developments in the Middle East.
"I wanted to come on this difficult day to the museum because this is a special place to celebrate the triumphs of the Jewish people when they are free from persecution. And on the solemn anniversary of October 7th and the terrorist attacks on Israel, this place of remembrance also reminds all of us of the horrors that befell the Jewish people when they were left without allies. So as we reflect on the pain and the tears of the slaughter last year, I want to start by praying fervently during the holiest days of the Jewish calendar for the safe return of the hostages. And you will hear me include that in virtually all my public remarks on any topic at this point until they are free. And all of you, I'm going to work as hard as I can for peace so that Jewish parents and Palestinian parents alike can live without fear for their children and families. Israel obviously teeters precariously on the brink of survival now, just as it did a year ago, at a life and death moment in its history. And just as Hamas terrorists attacked Israel on October 7th, hell-bent on murdering Jews and others, we know that Iran and their fanatic Hezbollah proxies are similarly hell-bent at this hour on Israel's destruction. Yesterday, I returned to Congregation Neve Shalom and had a chance to meet with Jewish families and others, and we recommitted to what I said last year in that sacred place after the unprecedented October 7th terrorist attack, even in the United States Senate, is that the alliance between the United States and Israel is essential, and it has to be eternal. So our message then, and our message again, is terrorism will not win, and the United States will stand with Israel. The alliance between the United States was etched in stone when President Truman sent a clear message from America in 1948. He recognized the state of Israel only 11 minutes into existence. So Israel was practically a baby, and Harry Truman recognized Israel as soon as it formally existed, setting in motion a rock-solid alliance between two democracies. And I want everyone to know that we can differ on the analysis of Bibi Netanyahu's actions leading up to October 7th and over the past year, but what we want to make sure today, and what I'm going to state, is Israel's eternal values are going to transcend and outlast some of the decisions by Benjamin Netanyahu. The long-term alliance between the United States and Israel is far more important and timeless than any leader's decisions driven by what often seems their best interest. So let's be clear, when we hear chants of from the river to the sea and other slogans channeling the false conclusion that being anti-Zionist cannot somehow not be anti-Jewish. The discussion over Zionism might have been an interesting academic or theoretical discussion in 1924, before 6 million Jews were murdered. But there can be no debate in 2024 when it's an existential question for a nation of more than 7 million Jews. These Israelis and their descendants deserve a secure home in the nation of Israel instead of being left to the mercies of Hamas and Hezbollah, Iran, and those who travel, and I use these words specifically, in anti-Semitism. The people of Israel are the latest generation of a people and a faith that suffered millennia of persecutions. from the Inquisition and the pogroms to the Holocaust and terrorist attacks of modern times in the Middle East, the Jewish people have needed and deserved their own nation. My parents fled the Nazis in the 30s. Not all got out. We lost family during Kristallnacht and Terezin. My dad was one of the Ritchie boys, the German kids who talked their way into the army so they could drop the propaganda pamphlets on the Nazis. And as I said yesterday at Neves Shalom, I found a picture recently of my dad, who was not exactly a physical specimen, but he was standing in front of a group of German soldiers, and he was reading to them the terms of surrender to the United States. And I could actually see a little smile creep out from his face, because for his new country, for the United States, that offered freedom and opportunity, he wanted to serve in any way that he could. So I continue to stand with Israel today and every day for generations to come, just as my parents started, and for the ultimate goal, so there's no confusion about today, the ultimate goal that allows Jewish parents and Palestinian parents to live in peace.
And that was Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden. And Oregon Congresswoman's also been drawing attention to anti-Semitism. The Committee on Education and the Workforce's ranking member, Suzanne Bonamici, had the opening remarks at a hearing on the rise of anti-Semitism in K-12 schools. She said that fighting anti-Semitism requires leaders to condemn it when they see it, regardless of who it comes from, even if that person is the head of your political party.
Many of my colleagues claim to care about the rise of anti-Semitism in this country. But when white supremacists marched in Charlottesville, Virginia, with burning torches and chanting, "Jews will not replace us," the president at the time, Donald Trump, said there were very fine people on both sides. One of the participants at that Unite the Right rally was Nick Fuentes, a vile anti-Semite, who, among other statements, has denied the scope of the Holocaust while comparing Jews exterminated in concentration camps to cookies being baked in an oven. Former President Trump hosted Nick Fuentes at Mar-a-Lago in November of 2022. General John Kelly, who served as then-President Trump's chief of staff, has stated that the former president spoke favorably about Hitler, including that Hitler had done some good things. And just a few months ago, Donald Trump said, quote, "Any Jewish person that votes for Democrats hates their religion." Despite these persistent examples of comments that others have called anti-Semitic, and continued relationships with well-known anti-Semites, I have not heard one word of concern from my colleagues across the aisle. In fact, what we have seen is consolidation of support for the former president. If my colleagues care about anti-Semitism, they would condemn and denounce these comments from the leader of their party. So I will offer my colleagues on the other side of the aisle the opportunity right now to condemn these previous comments. Does anyone have the courage to stand up against this? Let the record show that no one spoke up at this time.
President Biden denounces disinformation about the federal disaster response. Experts address concerns about how hurricanes impact voting. And activists, both left and right, ask about Vice President Harris's stance on meat. With more on the stories affecting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2024 Talks.
Assertions have been made that property is being confiscated. That's simply not true. They're saying people impacted by these storms will receive $750 in cash and no more. That's simply not true.
President Joe Biden is denouncing disinformation about federal hurricane response. Former President Donald Trump said money is being diverted to illegal migrants to pay them to vote, which Biden calls part of a reckless and irresponsible onslaught of lies. Hurricane Milton's intensity declined to Category 3 just as it made landfall late Wednesday, but it is still expected to rampage across the middle part of the Florida Peninsula. Some are watching the impact of the storms on the toss-up election. Florida Republican Carlos A. Jimenez says Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene should have her head examined for saying the government controlled the weather to send Hurricane Helene into conservative areas. David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation says judging from previous storms, election officials know what to do, but they have their hands full.
What we see is oftentimes polling sites, facilities are damaged or unusable, maybe because they're flooded or because they've lost power, and often Oftentimes, election officials have to find alternate locations for voting.
The Southern Poverty Law Center, the League of Women Voters, and the NAACP are suing to reopen Florida's voter registration period, which just ended. Larry Hannon with State Voices Florida says not doing so would, in effect, disenfranchise state citizens.
This is an issue of fairness, and I think it impacts all voters of Florida. This is not a liberal or conservative issue. You know, people coming into Florida or people turning 18 can be liberal or conservative.
At a Nevada rally, Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Walz highlighted the Biden-Harris administration's economic record, noting the nearly 300,000 new jobs created there. He's critical of former President Trump's and Ohio Senator J.D. Vance's plan to roll back the Inflation Reduction Act.
$500 million in Senator Vance's Ohio, and he called it like it's chump change or table scraps. Those are thousands of jobs. Those are making America energy independent. Those are bringing down our costs.
Vice President Kamala Harris's campaign announced it has raised an unprecedented $1 billion despite entering the race late. Though Harris has sponsored animal welfare legislation, activists say her record on factory farming isn't good. Andrew DeCoriolis with Farm Forward says presidents can impact the nation's food and agricultural policies.
If Congress knows that a president's priority is to work on a climate bill that includes certain values around climate smart agriculture, for example, or the prioritization of more climate friendly diets and a shift towards plant-based eating, that's much more likely to get pushed through.
At the same time, some conservatives have promoted a conspiracy theory that Harris wants to ban beef and pork, even though she's never supported any legislation to ban any kind of meat. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
In Oregon's rural communities, there are mixed feelings about ranked choice voting on the ballot. Roz Brown has more on the story.
Next month, five states, including Oregon, will decide if ranked choice voting should replace the winner-take-all system. If approved, voters would choose their top favorites rather than casting one vote, meaning everyone's second preference also could advance. Blair Bobier helped convince voters in Benton County, Oregon, to adopt the system in 2016.
It creates a more reflective and responsive democracy, and it results in better representation.
Not everyone's a fan. Some rural election officials worry it could confuse voters, open the system to charges of election fraud, and cost the counties more than they can afford. Steve Dennison is the clerk of Oregon's Deschutes County.
There are going to be other services that counties won't be able to provide because they're footing the bill for this additional cost for something that doesn't necessarily improve the process overall.
I'm Roz Brown.
Ohio's Capitol dives into a complicated reckoning about its namesake. And an Indian corn harvest at Hoshuck Farms preserves ancestors' methods. Here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Events across the country Monday will celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day instead of the federal holiday commemorating Christopher Columbus. As we approach the day, we're taking a look at the project Reimagining Columbus in the city of Columbus, Ohio. In 2020, the city removed a 20-foot, more than 3-ton bronze statue of Columbus at City Hall, which was a gift from an Italian city in the 1950s. The city of Columbus says, among things, the statue represents oppression to many in the community. Aaron Blue is with the city working on the project.
As the largest city in the United States, maybe the world, named after Christopher Columbus, we felt this was an opportunity for us to dive into the complicated reckoning with the namesake in a way that maybe other cities aren't.
Tamara Begay, founder of Indigenous Design Studio Plus Architecture, is part of the project team helping bring an Indigenous perspective.
We've heard things from the Indigenous communities that their voices are not taken seriously. And we hear that a lot. How do we respect these stories in a way that we can educate people? This history was told from one point of view, but there's other voices out there that we can move forward with.
Blue says the project has worked on building an understanding, which includes engaging with those who did not want the statue to come down, including members of the Italian American community.
We had family workshops. We've had nature walks to local Indigenous sites to build that experience with our community members. And so we're building understanding and connection. And once people get that, is the kind of the process is the point of the project, there's a different feel, there's different air in the room after that.
The area where the statue was could be a new statue, artwork, landscape, or building. Begay says she's approaching it with an Indigenous lens.
Connection to the earth, connection to the sky, connection to the two-legged beings, the four-legged beings, connection to the seasons, the cardinal directions, the infants, the youth, the elderly, really this clockwise thinking aspect of it. What it really tends goes back to this idea of working together in community aspect.
The Reimagining Columbus project is expected to have a final design by next spring or summer. Ho-Chunk Farm's annual Indian corn harvest is reviving and preserving the cultural tradition for the Nebraska tribe. Deborah Van Fleet has more.
Corn from a Winnebago family's heirloom seeds is grown organically, hand-picked, harvested, and processed as closely as possible to the way it was done by the tribe's ancestors. Ho-Chunk Farm's agriculture business manager, Corey Cleveland, says the Indian corn harvest involves several steps and several generations. He explains that after the corn is picked and husked, it's boiled and blanched for 10 to 15 minutes, followed by the wash goo.
A lot of our elders like to come and do the wash goo, and that's taking off kernel by kernel with hand and spoon. This is a time a lot of our elders will share stories.
Following the wash goo, the corn is dried on screens for 2 or 3 days and then put in quart-sized bags. Cleveland says the corn is then frozen and typically used in a traditional corn soup. He says approximately a third of this year's 350 quarts will be distributed to folks who helped with the process. Students in Winnebago Public Schools also participate in the Indian Corn Project. Cleveland says even students as young as first through third grade get involved by helping husk.
So it's good to have their help. If we can have them say, hey, mom and dad, I went to help with the Indian corn today. That is what we're trying to do with the Indian Corn Project.
The Indian Corn Project also contributes to the Winnebago tribe's goal of food sovereignty for its community. I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 10th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is myself, Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3